From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon, and this hour we speak with an Iranian protester who says the violence that's been turned on Iranians by their own government makes them want help from the U.S.
It's not like we want them to change the regime or anything. Iranian people will do it themselves, but we need help. We are empty-handed, standing in front of the bullet.
And later, sports, college football's championship and a college basketball betting scandal. The debut novel, The Infamous Gilberts, about secrets left in an old family manor. And the latest album from Langhorne Slim. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, January 17, 2026.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The Minnesota Public Utilities Commission has approved a site permit for Minnesota Power's Boswell Solar Project, an up to 85-megawatt solar facility in Itasca County. The Friday announcement says the commission also granted a route permit for the associated 2.5-mile, 230-kilovolt transmission line. The line will connect the project to the existing Boswell Energy Center substation. The project will be partially located in Cohasset, partially within Deer Lake Township, and partially within the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe Reservation, covering about 1,300 acres. About 500 of those acres will be occupied by solar panels and the associated infrastructure. The PUC says its decision followed a comprehensive environmental review and public engagement process. In response to feedback from nearby residents, tribal governments, and state agencies, the PUC established some permit conditions. These include requiring a detailed visual screening plan to address potential visual impacts to neighboring properties, as well as engagement with the Leech Lake Band on economic and workforce development opportunities. The Boswell Solar Project is a key component of Minnesota Power's Integrated Resource Plan, which requires the utility to procure up to 300 megawatts of regional solar energy. Construction is expected to begin early this year, with commercial operation anticipated in late 2027. Northern Minnesota will have one less school district this fall. The Carleton and Renshaw school boards officially voted to consolidate last week. The move has largely been driven by financial challenges. Without any snags, consolidation will officially be on July 1st. The Cloquet Pine Journal reports a petition circulating the Renshaw School District may have enough votes to force a referendum on consolidation. If that happens, a special election will be April 14th. Renshaw Board Chair Mary Carlson told the Pine Journal she's confident consolidation would still pass. Over the next few months, committees will start to decide details like which buildings the new district will use, grade configurations, transportation, staffing, and more. Grocery shoppers can't help but feel frustration when a staple like eggs sees rapid price swings. One Minnesota farmer is helping her neighbors by offering a quality product that's not only predictable with costs, but also an excuse for social interaction. Egg prices are trending lower since supplies recovered from bird flu outbreaks, but Brittany Johnson says record highs from last year are still on her mind as she nears the first anniversary of the egg cooperative on her northwestern Minnesota farm. How it works is a member signs up for $10 a month and gets a dozen eggs each week. Johnson says at $2.50 a carton, that gives community members peace of mind in case the market unravels. Excess supplies are donated to neighbors in need.
For us, people like to know where their food is coming from, and they like to support good companies, but those can be hard to come by for food products. And so the natural solution is just to start your own. And all of the co-op members have become my best friends. So it's been really fun.
Johnson says she often delivers the eggs herself and recycles the cartons. The chickens are raised through rotational grazing, limiting harmful elements from reaching local waterways. Right now, the co-op is small, and there's a waiting list, and Johnson likes it that way. She says a challenge is limiting any temptation to scale up and create food production side effects she's trying to avoid with this model. Johnson says she recently invested in a specialized farm wagon so she can buy chicken feed directly from the local grain elevator, potentially lowering those costs by 40 to 50%. It all adds up to an operation built around flexibility.
Sometimes people pay 3 months at a time. Sometimes they pay 1 month. And then sometimes they pick up their eggs every 1 week or every 2 weeks, whatever works for the people in the co-op.
Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. The U.S. Forest Service is restricting public access to Superior National Forest's Eagle Mountain Trailhead parking lot and trail beginning Monday. The trail is located in the Gunflint Ranger District in Cook County. The closure is to protect the safety of Forest Service staff and sled dogs using the trails for material hauling. Project work is planned Monday through Friday, the weeks of January 19th and 26th. The area will reopen to the public from noon on Friday through the end of day Sunday next weekend. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The U.S. Justice Department is investigating Minnesota's Governor Tim Walz and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey. This is according to U.S. officials who requested anonymity because they are not authorized to discuss the matter publicly. And it comes as the governor, the mayor, and Minnesota's Democratic leaders have vocally criticized the Trump administration's aggressive immigration enforcement actions in their state. In a post online, Governor Walz said, quote, "Weaponizing the justice system against your opponents is an authoritarian tactic." We begin this hour of the program with Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters.
President Trump is floating the idea of using the Insurrection Act in Minnesota to deploy troops to the state.
"And if I needed it, I'd use it. I don't think there's any reason right now to use it. But if I needed it, I'd use it. It's very powerful."
It comes as his administration has clashed with Democratic leaders here for weeks now. Take last weekend, for example. Three Democratic members of the Minnesota congressional delegation walked to the front of an ICE detention center just outside Minneapolis. Representatives Ilhan Omar, Angie Craig, and Kelly Morrison were surrounded by press and a handful of protesters.
"We're not going to be able to talk to them if you guys block us from our ability to speak to them."
The members of Congress had called the facility ahead of showing up and told them they were coming to conduct an oversight check. Under federal law, members of Congress have the right to make unannounced visits to certain ICE facilities. The three were allowed in for about 10 minutes, then turned away. Here's Representative Omar.
"What happened today is a blatant attempt to obstruct members of Congress from doing their oversight duties."
The three were there just days after ICE agent Jonathan Ross fatally shot Renee Macklin Good. They wanted more time to see the center's conditions and how those detained were being treated. But in a memo from Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem obtained by NPR, she says ICE needs 7 days' notice. Here she is Thursday talking about the possibility of using the Insurrection Act.
"My hope is that this leadership team in Minnesota will start to work with us to get criminals off the streets."
Minnesota has been a focal point for Trump's political ire since the year began. Clashes between protesters, ICE observers, and agents continue. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz backed out of his bid for a third term last week, saying running for re-election would prevent his full attention from governing the state and rooting out fraud. He continues to plead with the Department of Homeland Security to loosen its grip here. The former Democratic vice presidential candidate said last week that protesters here need to hold the line.
"We can look out for one another. We can have differences, but we've proved to the world going on 250 years that our democracy could hold. It feels to me like we're at one of those inflection points."
Vice President J.D. Vance has a different take.
"Look, Tim Walz is a joke. His entire administration has been a joke. The idea that he's some sort of freedom fighter, he's not."
In most cases, Democrats have not been able to completely push back against the Trump administration. University of Minnesota political science professor Michael Minta says there was some dissent from moderate Republicans during Trump's first term. This time around, Democrats don't control the House or Senate. They could use the support of moderate GOP members, but
they're not necessarily coming out in favor of Republicans or Trump policies, but they're not doing anything to stop it. And so that makes it very difficult for the minority party, for Democrats, to really mount any type of opposition.
Democratic U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota says she's seriously considering a run for governor with Walz not running again. And Klobuchar says her party needs to focus on picking up a majority in Congress.
We need a check on Donald Trump. He will not have this unbridled power if there can be a House of Representatives or a Senate that can rein him in.
But there's still a little less than a year until voters can change the makeup of Congress. The state's attorney general has sued the feds to try and halt ICE operations here. There's no sign the president will relent on his immigration crackdown, and Democrats don't have many options for pushing back. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in Minneapolis.
At least 3,000 people in Iran have died in protests, with many more detained, according to the U.S.-based human rights activist news agency. An internet blackout has made it difficult to independently confirm that information, but images that trickle out of the country show a violent government response to protesters calling for reforms, regime change, and in some cases for the return of Reza Pahlavi, the son of Iran's king who was deposed in 1979. We're joined now by one of those protesters. She has family in Iran, and she fears for their safety, so we will refer to her simply by her initial, A. And please note, she has been witness to some disturbing scenes. A, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. And this is important for everyone, the whole world, to know actually, really what's happening there. So thank you.
You're out of the country now, but you were in Iran last week and protesting, as I understand it. What did you see?
Thousands and millions, actually, of people came to the streets in Tehran and Karaj and many, many other cities. At first, I saw that the regular police with the normal police uniforms, they were attacking protesters where we were actually pushing them back. Mm-hmm. And then Basij and Iran Revolutionary Guard, IRGC.
Yeah.
Most of them, they were speaking in Arabic, okay? Mm-hmm. And they started shooting directly at people, hearts and heads, without considering this, that some of them were kids, some of them were very, very young people, some of them were elderly, you know? And they were shooting on this guy, okay? And we thought, okay, this is tear gas. But it was exploding up and up in the sky. And around 50 bullets was spreading from that. And it was hitting 50 more or less people at once.
This was like bullets falling from the sky? Or?
It was exploding, and it was 50 bullets out of that, like spreading all over the people.
What are the protests about? That sounds naive, but what are people talking about? Why are they brave enough to come out in the streets?
The collapse of currency, economy situation, and lack of freedom, lack of food, money. I don't know everything. People are frustrated. People are like, we cannot take this anymore. We don't want this anymore. You know, this time, everybody was calling the prince, Reza Pahlavi. They were shouting, in Akharin Nabard, Pahlavi Barmigare, this is the last fight Pahlavi will return to the country.
Do you hope that Reza Pahlavi, if he were to come back and come into power, would hold democratic elections?
Yeah, 100%. And he doesn't want power. He doesn't want anything. He just wants to help for transition, this transition time, and then he will hold an election. He cannot be a dictator.
You believe these demonstrations are different?
I strongly believe that this demonstration was totally, totally different than the ones in years ago. It's not for hijab. It's not for the votes. It's not, it is for the change of regime. It is for them to go. They don't want them anymore. People had enough. And let me tell you about the worst part that I saw. That it always makes me cry. On Thursday, they were putting laser on people. They were these red lights like a laser. And they were scaring people that they're going to shoot at people. But at the end, they didn't shoot. And it was a trick because on Friday, they did the same and they shoot. With my own eyes, I saw bodies on top of the bodies in Karaj, in Chara Gulzar. And they were running by their motorbikes on the on bodies, and they were dancing around them with their guns, celebrating their victory or whatever. And the street was full of blood. I don't know. I felt like I was in a nightmare. It was not real, but I was standing there. I was alive. It was real.
Do you want the world to do something? Do you want the United States to do something?
Yeah. It's not like we want them to change the regime or anything. Iranian people will do it themselves sooner or later, but we need help. We are empty-handed, standing in front of the bullet. If they have to kill all of us, they will kill all of us.
What would you want the world to do, or the United States?
Well, Trump a few times stated that help is coming and you're not alone. And when he didn't do anything, it is a bit disappointing. We need U.S. to target IRGC bases. And if the world is going to be quiet about it and do nothing about it, it just says one thing. They are with them. They support this regime.
Do you have any hope right now?
For the change of regime?
Yeah.
We have never been any closer to freedom than we are now. If U.S. wants to do something, it has to be now.
A is what we're calling her. One of the many Iranians who's taken part in protests there in recent weeks. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for listening.
And you're listening to NPR News.
Hi, I'm Elsa Chang from National Public Radio. We bring you the news and voices of people across the nation each and every day. We are proud of the work that we do, but we want to remind you that local affiliates like KAXE bring you the voices of your friends and neighbors. From arts reporting on area voices to local and state sports or clean energy and economic development, they reflect what life is like in rural northern Minnesota. Your support is critical to the work they do, where you learn about high school students in debate, to the sacredness of water and wild rice, to the history and future of forests in the region. Being a member makes this all possible, so please go to kaxe.org.
It's 19 minutes after 8 o'clock. Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXE and Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Jerry Bredeman, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. At noon, the recorded history of jazz with Paul Kivi. And 1 o'clock, Native Lights podcast. And 1:30, it's the Season Watch podcast. This week, I got to sit in with Charlie Mitchell, and we talked about the things you can see from your window. We'll hear a conversation with Pam Perry, as we do each month, talking about the birds outside her window, and we'll hear from Marshall Helmberger from the Timberjay newspaper about the lynx he was seeing at the beginning of the year. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Rapids Arts, connecting artists and audience, encouraging creativity and collaboration through monthly First Friday art walks and more. Information at grandrapidsarts.org. We continue with Weekend Edition on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. came into his job vowing to shake things up at the Department of Health and Human Services. Here he is in a social media video back in March, just after he was sworn in.
We're going to eliminate an entire alphabet soup of departments and agencies while preserving their core functions by merging them into a new organization called the Administration for a Healthy America, or AHA.
Secretary Kennedy did follow through on eliminating thousands of staff and departments, but whatever happened to AHA? NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin has been looking into this. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Scott.
Does the Administration for a Healthy America, AHA, exist?
No, it does not. And not only that, there's almost no public information about when it will be formed and what it will include. I called staff at congressional committees that oversee the Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS, and they say there aren't even preliminary planning meetings happening. There's no mention of AHA in the latest HHS funding bill. And all of this is important because standing up a new agency is really difficult.
How?
Well, you need a lot of input and planning and political will. Kathleen Sebelius was health secretary under President Obama, and during her tenure, she created a small agency, the Administration for Community Living, which helps people with disabilities and seniors live independently. Here is what she told me.
We took, a year to have listening sessions. It ultimately was in a budget document. And had, staff recommendations, had jurisdiction recommendations.
She says she doesn't see any of that going on when it comes to AHA.
A lot of what I see in these restructuring documents under Secretary Kennedy just absolutely are baffling to me.
I asked HHS about the lack of public information and congressional engagement, and a spokesperson declined to comment. And I should point out that Kennedy did not previously have experience in government or running a large, complex organization.
So Secretary Kennedy clearly wants to reshape HHS. AHA is a part of that. What exactly would it do?
Well, the name AHA is clearly a play on MAHA, the Make America Healthy Again slogan that Kennedy loves. The last public document on this from HHS was published way back in July. And that said that AHA will, quote, focus on areas including primary care, environmental health, HIV/AIDS, maternal and child health, mental and behavioral health, and workforce development, unquote. Those functions are currently spread out all over HHS. Some are at the CDC in Atlanta. Others are at the Mental Health Agency or the Health Services Agencies, both of which are in Maryland. So there are major logistical questions about how to move all of these around and consolidate them, especially without Congress's help. And adding to this complexity, there's a federal lawsuit in Rhode Island that has paused some of the firings and HHS's reorganization, and the legal process is still playing out there.
But does this mean there'll be no AHA?
Well, not necessarily. I have spoken to several senior career officials at HHS, and they say there are meetings related to AHA happening at the agency, but they're extremely secretive. I spoke to a senior CDC official who asked NPR not to use their name because they fear professional repercussions. They described getting asked constantly for information about staffing and programs without even knowing the names of the people asking, just that they're in close contact with Secretary Kennedy and they want information urgently. And the fact that there are meetings happening related to AHA, but that Congress isn't in the picture, makes some staffers I talked to speculate that HHS is going to create some sort of entity on its own with existing money and existing staff and call it AHA to sidestep the trouble of making a whole new agency and dealing with Congress.
Would that work?
Maybe. I mean, there could be some consolidation at the agency level, but Sebelius, the secretary under President Obama, told me that she's skeptical. Here's what she said.
You know, you can shuffle chairs around at HHS all you want and move it around, but at the end of the day, they're going to have some funding, some jurisdiction.
She says for AHA to become a reality, Congress is either going to need to buy into the idea or reject it. And she's not sure which way they're going to go.
And Selena, this week, of course, marked the end of open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act. And an announcement came from President Trump. What are the highlights?
Well, of course, you've heard all about how costs in the ACA are sky high for a lot of people because the enhanced subsidies expired at the end of December in these plans. Not surprisingly, enrollment appears to have dipped during open enrollment on healthcare.gov. And anecdotally, I've talked to a lot of people who've made the tough decision to become uninsured because they can't afford the premiums. The Senate looked like it was going to put together a bipartisan deal on those subsidies. But then on Thursday of this week, President Trump released his own health priorities without any extension of those subsidies. And that seems to have taken the wind out of those talks. So we'll have to see when lawmakers return after their break if the negotiations are paused or if there's still hope they could be revived.
And Pierre Selena Simmons Duffin, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Virginia swears in its 75th governor today. The Commonwealth holds inaugurations in traditional style. Think about men in coattails and waistcoats and the occasional top hat. But today's ceremony will include something new. There will be a woman at the center, Governor-elect Abigail Spanberger, a Democrat. Here's member station WAMU's Margaret Barthel.
What do you do when the state protocol guide just doesn't include you? If you're Spanberger, you say no thanks to the morning suit that your male predecessors have been wearing to inaugurations for decades.
But there's no requirements for what women wear, what women do. And so, you know, I'm not going to wear a morning coat, not to disappoint anyone.
Spanberger says she wants her inauguration to nod to tradition, but showcase the modern vibrancy and diversity of the Commonwealth. It helps that the other two leaders taking office are also breaking boundaries. Ghazala Hashmi will become the lieutenant governor and the first Muslim woman sworn into a statewide office anywhere in the country. Jay Jones will become the Commonwealth's first Black attorney general. Spanberger's own historic first didn't come up a whole lot on the campaign trail, perhaps because the three-term congresswoman and former CIA officer was running against another woman, Republican Winsome Earle Sears, for the job. Spanberger won a decisive 15-point victory in November.
My fellow Virginians.
In her victory speech, she paid tribute to the Virginia women who have gone before, including Barbara Johns, a Black teenage activist who, in 1951, led a school walkout to protest school segregation, and Mary Sue Terry, the first woman elected to a statewide position.
That felt very good, remarkably good.
That's Terry herself, a Democrat who served 8 years in the House of Delegates and another 8 as Attorney General. She ran for governor in 1993, but lost to Republican George Allen. During the campaign, opponents criticized her for being unmarried and childless. A month before Election Day, Terry was accused of covering up a relationship with another woman. That allegation came from a psychiatrist being prosecuted by Terry's office for having sex with minors. He ultimately lost his medical license.
It discouraged, I was afraid, and I'm sure it did, women and girls from not wanting to go through the same experience.
In her concession speech after she lost the race for governor 3 decades ago, Terry told her supporters she believed another woman would succeed one day.
Somewhere in Virginia tonight, the first woman governor of Virginia is watching.
Spanberger was in 9th grade at the time.
I remember my mother and her excitement. I'm the oldest of 3 daughters. Her excitement about, you know, we might have a woman governor.
Past aside, Spanberger has a big job ahead of her. She'll need to steer Virginia through a lagging economy and federal cuts to health care and the social safety net, which she says will deeply affect Virginia women, particularly mothers caring for children.
It's becoming incumbent on states to endeavor to bridge the gap where possible to ensure that it's not kids and their caregivers who are bearing the largest brunt of those choices.
But she's also relishing the chance to shape a new image of what a Virginia governor can be, as one father recently told her.
When he was leaving his home that afternoon, he said, "Oh, I'm going to go meet the next governor." And his little daughter said, "Okay, well, tell him hello." And he said to his daughter, "Actually, no, it's a woman. The next governor is a woman." And the little girl said, "A girl governor?"
For NPR News, I'm Margaret Barthel in Richmond, Virginia.
And now it's time for sports. And the last time for another sports gambling scandal. Also NFL playoffs and the college football championship. Sports reporter Michelle Steele joins us. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
Federal prosecutors in Pennsylvania charged 26 players this week in a widespread college basketball point-shaving scheme. 17 schools. The indictment alleges that a gambling ring fixed dozens of games in the previous two seasons. Sports betting keeps expanding. And can fans at this point, do we have to wonder, is what we're seeing and caring about real?
Sure. I mean, that's a real valid point. College basketball already has a tough time getting folks to watch outside of March Madness. So when you have 26 players charged across 17 schools for taking bribes to tank games, including from some big names like DePaul and Georgetown, yeah. Scott, it's a gut punch. You know, what stinks is that for the players who aren't involved, every time there's a missed layup, you know, you're going to hear a couple cynical fans mutter to each other about it being a, you know, business decision as opposed to just a missed shot. But we've invited the sports book in the arena. Can't be too shocked. Guys are checking the spread in the hallway.
I do want to ask about NFL playoffs. Divisional round, 8 teams remaining, including the Bears. 4 great matchups today and tomorrow. Josh Allen and the Buffalo Bills begin this afternoon against the Denver Broncos. What games are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm in Chicago, so all together now, Scott, the Bears
game. And the pride and joy of Illinois.
Yeah, Chicago hosting the Rams tomorrow. The Rams are flying in today, and on the way to their hotel, I saw a billboard, Scott, that says, "Hey, L.A., we dare you to lick the goalpost."
Oh, that's harsh, yes.
Welcome to Chicago. But looking at the games for today, you have to love Bills at Broncos, you know, Josh Allen versus Bo Nix. But the game I'm going to be keeping a close eye on is 49ers-Seahawks, classic NFC West rivalry. And yeah, one of these teams, of course, Scott, will be playing Chicago can dream. The Bears, perhaps, in the conference championship. We'll see.
College football championship game on Monday. Do the Miami Hurricanes have any chance against the Indiana Hoosiers?
I don't know. I think they're going to get a nasty dose of Hoosier hospitality. Indiana, 15-0, looking for the perfect season. And, of course, they're playing in Miami's backyard. But their offense is a machine. They're just good everywhere, Scott. Yeah. Miami's going to have to be mistake-free. I think Kurt Cignetti, who, by the way, has an amazing name, Coach Sig is what they call him. I think that this guy completes the most remarkable turnaround that I've ever seen in college football, just 2 seasons. My pick here, I think Indiana's going to be your national champions. And don't forget, their quarterback, Fernando Mendoza, from Miami. You couldn't script it any better.
Look, a rather extraordinary scandal is rocking ski jumping. This is right before the Winter Olympics. 2 Norwegian coaches and the team's suit technician.
Yes.
We don't have one on our staff here.
Have
received an 18-month suspension for what? Let's be careful how we explain this, Michelle Steele.
Yeah, this is a special one, Scott. Let's just say the Norwegian coaches and their technician that you referred to caught on video performing some creative tailoring on these ski suits. And, you know, we're not just talking about sewing a button or, you know, darning a sock or something or I don't know. I'm not a sewer myself, so I don't know what the verbiage is. But they were adding illegal, non-elastic stitching. Can I say this on NPR? To the crotch area? of the jumping suits?
Well, you've said it already, so okay, it's fine. Well, yes, you can say it, yes.
What this does, it turns the trousers into human flying squirrel suits. Great for distance, not great for the not cheating part of the Olympics, Scott.
Michelle Steele, it's good to have you on the important stories.
It is an important story. On that note.
Exactly.
On that note, let's see what Chicago does tomorrow night.
All right, so thanks very much. Talk to you soon. And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Youngsters involved in scouting famously earn badges for things like fishing, music, even nuclear science. It takes 21 merit badges to become an Eagle Scout, the top rank of scouting. And as St. Louis Public Radio's Lucretia Wembley reports, one Eagle Scout in Missouri hit that goal and proceeded to collect every other badge on offer.
Scouting America's Court of Honor ceremony formally recognizes scouts for their achievements. And on this day, it's being held for 18-year-old John Hayes. It begins with a color guard. Scouts from Missouri's Great Rivers Council, dressed in tan and green uniforms, march in holding flags of the United States and the city of Lake Ozark.
Color guard, attention, forward march.
That's followed by the Pledge of Allegiance. And Master of Ceremonies John Detzel talks about the importance of the Scout Law as he reads from an old Scout handbook.
Here's my favorite ones. A Scout is trustworthy.
As he continues reciting the law, a beaming Hayes wearing a sash full of badges stands nearby. Later, he talks about his merit badge journey.
It all started back in Cub Scouts. I didn't really get the passion to get all the merit badge because I didn't know about merit badges and Scouts. But I had an amazing den chief, Dave Weaver. He ignited my passion for scouting in a very strong way. I started to love every bit of it.
It didn't take long for Hayes, then an 11-year-old new member of Troop 21, to set a lofty goal.
Did my first merit badge. Thought it was pretty cool.
That one was for space exploration.
Did my second merit badge. I was like, I want to do every single one of these.
And that was a big dream. The number of merit badges has grown over the years from just 14 in the early 1900s when scouting began to more than 100 by the time Hayes began collecting them. Amanda Hayes says scouting gave her son opportunities to travel the world and learn some valuable life skills, like how to provide first aid. She also made a deal with him since there can be out-of-pocket costs for badges. She told him if he saved his money and paid his own merit badges, she'd handle everything else.
And he did that. He's paid for every single merit badge he did. I said, I'll cover the gas and my time. You cover all your merit badges.
And out of the 140, Hayes has a favorite.
Climbing was my favorite one. At the Lake Ozark Scout Reservation, I took the climbing ridge like 7 to 10 times, somewhere around there, which just kept going back to do it. I loved it so much.
And the last badge he earned was for bugling. John Fapsitz, scout executive for the Great Rivers Council, says earning the merits does require a lot of time and energy, but it's worth it.
So it's an introduction again to those potential careers, hobbies, things to interest a kid on what they want to do with the rest of their life.
And Hayes has already made a decision about careers. He has a student pilot license and started flying airplanes a year ago. He wants to be a professional pilot just like his grandfather, who is an aviation merit badge counselor. And he has a bit of advice for younger scouts.
Keep pushing yourself. Try harder and harder at things. It's good to fail, of course. That's a big thing with scouts, because when you fail, you learn. And be a good person. I'm sad that it's always all over, but I mean, it's good to have it done.
Now, John Hayes joins a special group of just over 600 scouts who earned as many merit badges as they could. For NPR News, I'm Lucretia Wembley in Lake Ozark, Missouri.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to KAXC and Weekend Edition. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. It's 8:39. Mostly cloudy to partly sunny today, high 0 to 7, winds from the northwest 10 to 25 miles per hour. Lows tonight around 10 below 0, and tomorrow snow possible before noon, 1/2 to 2 inches expected, high 6 to 13. Lows tomorrow night 10 to 15 below 0, and cold on Monday with highs 4 below to 1 above. We invite you to join us next Saturday, January 24th, for Ski Palooza at Three Island Park in Bemidji. That's from noon to 3. You can come cross-country ski, snowshoe, fat tire bike, play music, or just swap stories around the fire. You can bring a snack to share. Mike Sturck will present the local history talk Echoes Beyond the Pit on Friday, January 23rd, 1 o'clock at the Hoyt Lakes Public Library. Learn about the Erie Preliminary Taconite Plant and how the town of Hoyt Lakes was born. More news is next on KAXE.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. President Trump is floating the idea of imposing tariffs on countries that don't support his push for U.S. control of Greenland. He hasn't said which nations might be targeted or what authority he would use. Officials in Indonesia say a search is underway for a small passenger plane that is believed to have crashed. Authorities say 11 people are on board. Emergency teams have been deployed to a mountainous area near the last location of the aircraft. The United Nations General Assembly is marking its 80th anniversary this weekend. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says global cooperation is needed now more than ever. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thornwalk House is a mighty English mansion of the Winfred Gilbert family. That has been sold and will be turned into a hotel. So there is a last tour of the objects inside and around the decaying Gothic building. The empty bed, a bump in the lawn, the shadow of the taxidermied moose head. What will become of them and the stories they tell about the people who once lived there? The infamous Gilberts is Angela Tomasky's debut novel. She has held a variety of jobs, which we will ask her about. She joins us now from the studios of the BBC in London. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And tell us, please, about our tour guide, Maximus.
Maximus takes the reader on a tour of this house, and he's someone who loves the family deeply. He knows all their secrets, all their stories. So I think there's quite a bit of darkness in the story, and because of the love he has for them, I think it sort of balances that darkness.
Yeah. Five children, Lydia, Hugo, Annabelle, Jeremy, and Rosalind. As children, they're pretty much left to their own devices, aren't they? Why?
Well, there's no father, so the father is absent, and the mother is unable to sort of compensate for that absence. So yes, they are left without really the tools that they need to go forward.
And tell us about Hugo, the eldest son. Comes back a changed young man from the war, doesn't he?
He does. So he's obviously scarred by his experiences. But I think for me, the bigger issue is the fact that he has a role to fill. And because there is no father there, he has to take on, you know, far too much responsibility from an early age. And he's unable to do that. He's not equipped. For me, he was a sort of thwarted hero. He wants to save people. And when he's unable to do that, the darkness sort of comes out.
Are we right to see Hugo's challenges to be of a piece with the desiccated condition of Thornwalk?
Yes, I mean, the decay of Thornwalk, it's that this idea of the disintegration, I suppose, of traditional family structures, traditional power structures. So this family is falling apart, and Hugo is unable to hold it together. So yes, he disintegrates, you know, with it. He refuses to leave it. The two sort of decay together.
What put this house in mind for you as a vehicle by which to tell stories?
In 2002, there's this beautiful, magnificent neo-Gothic mansion called Tinsfield near Bristol. And I went on a tour of that house just after it was acquired by the National Trust. The sort of the last owner had died there. And I saw the bed in which the sort of reclusive last Baron was said to have died. And it was such a powerful sort of scene. I remember the smell of a little tablet of coal tar soap and a pair of slippers under the bed. When I went back on a tour later, the bed had been removed, the soap, the slippers, everything had gone. And that vivid link to the past obviously was lost. So that was what put in mind this idea of the importance of these objects, just that the smell of the soap and something that he had held and the things that are important to us and that do hold meaning. So I wanted to tell a story in the form of a tour using objects like that that seem inconsequential but actually hold a lot of meaning.
Can you tell us, without giving away too much, about the burn on the library rug?
What happens is that there's a fire, a spark lands on the rug and sets it alight, and Annabelle is having a sort of blackout and she can't see the fire. So this signals to the reader the fact that Annabelle has a sort of medical condition, that she has some sort of challenges which make her vulnerable. So with the absence of the father for her, you know, she is then damaged in a way that wouldn't have happened had someone been there to sort of protect her. And I think in life for me personally and the things I've seen in people around me, when you don't have a father there to protect you, it seems like a simple thing, but people do treat you slightly differently. You're almost like a little bit of a sitting duck, you know, and she was vulnerable to certain forces that wanted her to be a little bit different, to sort of normalize her.
Do you know what it's like to grow up without a father?
I do. Yes, I do. And this was the story that's been in me for a long time. You're sort of, you know, 20 years thinking about the Gilberts and how they might tell the story. But, you know, obviously my whole life, you know, since the age of nine, feeling I had something to say about this. And all the issues that we see in the Gilberts, you know, I've experienced myself to some extent, you know. So, yes, I know.
Does it make it painful or cathartic or a little of both to write about in a novel?
Cathartic, yes, absolutely. And it's strange, but it feels better not just to write it, but to be heard, for people to be reading it, to be able to share it with people is like a weight has been lifted somehow.
Oh, good. Your bio says you have been, I'm going to quote now, a waitress, cleaner, English teacher, and activity coordinator in a care home.
Yes.
What did you learn from each of those jobs that you might call on now to become a novelist?
Just people, I suppose, ordinary people. The care home particularly was wonderful, seeing people at their most vulnerable, really, and open, and finding such beauty in it, such precious moments. I think I never would have worked in a care home if I hadn't been sort of, you know, desperate for money. It's a difficult job for someone who's actually quite introverted, you know, leading singing sessions and things like that. It's not my normal sort of thing, but it's one of the best things I've ever done. And I look back on it with, I just feel really grateful to have done it.
Sounds like it opened a lot of human lives to you.
Yes, and beautiful human lives. And at the time, I didn't know, I was very open to it. So I'd lived, I'd been working from home for a long time. And I just needed an extra job, a little bit of extra money. But I'd been quite isolated. So I was very open to forming sort of friendships with these people, sort of forming relationships, perhaps too much, really. And it was only in a training session, sort of 18 months later, they said, remember, you're not meant to be their friend. And I put up my hand and queried this, because I thought you were, as an activity coordinator, meant to sort of form this sort of bond. But of course, it's a professional relationship. Of course it is. And it stands to reason. But I think they meant so much to me. And I did grieve when they died, you know.
Yeah. I'm really struck by a line toward the end of your novel, where you say, the narrator says, we are all the ruins of castles.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just very strange, because it's my favorite line, because this beautiful Gothic mansion, even though it inspired the book, you know, it is really rather, it's sort of incidental. These are ordinary people with ordinary issues, you know, and I just wanted this beautiful Gothic mansion is as a sort of frame to them, to elevate them, to signal how important these people are, as we all are. You know, all our stories are important. And that this idea that when a person dies, it's a castle that crumbles. You know, there are no unimportant people. We're all the ruins of castles. We're once mighty. And when we have to fall, you know.
Angela Tomasky's debut novel, The Infamous Gilberts. So good to have you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
For more than two decades, Sean Skolnick, known in the music world as Langhorne Slim, has been a folk troubadour. Maybe it's time for a change?
We're gonna rock and roll tonight. We're gonna live until we die. We gotta get low sometimes, but we're gonna get high.
This is the track Rock and Roll from Langhorne Slim's new album, The Dreamin' Kind. And Langhorne Slim joins us now from the studios of WFUV on the campus of Fordham University of New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
What a pleasure, and a surreal pleasure. I've heard this voice on the radio for so many years.
Well, pleasure is ours. Thank you. You take your stage name from your hometown, Langhorne, Pennsylvania. Langhorne, let's put it this way, doesn't sound to me exactly like folksy territory.
No, it's a suburb of Philly. And, you know, the suburbs are an interesting place to grow up. And for me, like a lot of kids, I'm sure, didn't feel like I fit in exactly perfectly with the environment and with the public school system. And though that was challenging at the time, it drove me into the basement and into the bedroom with a record player and a CD player and eventually a guitar.
This is your ninth studio album, and it does seem to be a change in direction, but you say it grows naturally out of your life.
I was thinking of stuff that I love to listen to, so I can listen to Woody Guthrie, and I could listen to Wu-Tang Clan, and I can listen to The Clash, and all of that music, to me, is folk music. It's music for the people. It's rebel music. It's music that is seeking and searching, I think, for something higher as in the human condition. So all of it sounds different when you listen to it on record, but it gives me the same feeling. I can find a connection with all of that stuff.
Do I hear a lot of 70s in this album?
I think you do hear some 70s in this album, yeah. I'm certainly not going for like a retro thing. I want something that could have been made before, could have been made now, could have been made tomorrow, and hopefully will make sense in years to come when you listen to it.
Let me show you my love and devotion. My love is deeper than the depths of the ocean. I'm on fire. I'm on fire.
You performed this week on The Daily Show. Jordan Klepper was host, and you've recently opened for him on a comedy tour.
Yeah.
Is it tough to be a musician opening for a stand-up comedian?
I once had the opportunity to open many, many, many years ago for a great comedian named Eugene Merman, who I love and adore. And I could remember back then, nobody knew who I was. And so I would come out dressed funny like I still do, and people would just start laughing, thinking that I was like a musical comedian, and I would sing some heartfelt love song. And those shows were tough, though educational. But these were just theaters full of people that I think, when what I've, you know, coming out of the pandemic, I'm a somewhat new father. Presence and connection, I think, is what we are all hoping for. It's just the energy that I'm trying to carry with me and the crowds that I've come across. I feel a heightened sense of that. And so if I could bring that in song and story on stage, that's what I feel like I was met back with. There wasn't a whole lot of resistance. They were very warm, wonderful crowds.
Morning came and morning went, never once by accident. Life is short and life is long. Something good is coming soon, but you gotta keep your eyes wide open.
You have been very open, both musically and in interviews, about trying to break away from a dependency on prescription medication, especially anti-anxiety pills.
Mm-hmm.
Now that you're, well, firstly, how are you?
I'm good. I just celebrated 6 years sober. And as they say, one day at a time.
Yeah.
But I am good today.
And why was this important to you?
Well, my friend, if I may call you my friend.
Please.
It's a struggle that I've dealt with my whole life. Anxiety, bouts of depression, and addiction. And I tried, over 10 years ago, I tried for the first time getting clean. But I wasn't doing anything else. I wasn't connecting with other people trying to live a sober life. I wasn't involved in any program or in therapy, any of that stuff that I currently do. And I was in a situation very similar to the one I find myself in today, where I had a new record out at the time, and I had big expectations, and I didn't realize that my ego and my expectations were out of whack. It took getting pretty beat up, as it does, to finally find the switch within myself that I checked myself into rehab in Nashville 6 years ago, entered a program that I've, to my surprise, I've learned to love, and my life has changed dramatically. I mean, there's no way that I could be a father. There's no way that I could really attempt to be on a call like this with you and try to be truly honest and present, you know, without some of the steps that I've made.
Let me ask you about the song Loyalty. So is this some of what we've been talking about?
Yes, sir. Yeah, it's exactly what we were just talking about. And man, it's easy to run. For those that like to run, it's easy to run. And yeah, you need loyalty to love.
Sounds like you're doing well now. But you're constantly, what, vigilant, right?
I am vigilant. And nobody makes it through life unscathed, you know? It's an impossibility. And so the scars are beautiful, and they help us to our healing. I heard somebody say the wound is where the healing is, and I really like that.
There's also hope on this album, isn't there? And tenderness. I'm thinking of a song like Dream Come True.
Indeed.
You and me, baby. We are the dreaming kind, and they say we're crazy. Maybe we are sometimes, but they always say so many things.
That's a song for my little boy that I started writing maybe 15 years ago, and it was about something totally different. And now my son walks around the house singing that song, and it makes me cry, man. It's so sweet. It's just magical.
Langhorne Slim, his new album, The Dreamin' Kind, is out now. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation at WTGrantFoundation.org.
It's just before 9 o'clock. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, Stay Human with Michael Goldberg, Stories for Winter Survival. 10 o'clock, Jerry Bredeman, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Support comes from First National Bank Bemidji, helping local families and businesses reach their financial goals. First National Bank Bemidji, better together, member FDIC. Mostly cloudy to partly sunny today, highs 0 to 7, northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour. Lows tonight 7 to 11 below zero. And tomorrow, snow possible in the morning, 1/2 inch to 2 inches possible, and highs 6 to 13. Lows tomorrow night, 10 to 15 below, and for Monday, mostly cloudy, cold once again, highs 4 below to 1 above, and lows Monday night down into the teens below zero. Looking ahead to Tuesday, a bit warmer with highs in the single digits above. There is a free community meal tomorrow at Chair on Chestnut Street in downtown Virginia from noon to 3, offering food and clothing distribution as well to those in need. If you do have items to donate, you can bring them to Chair at any time.